Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Our topic today is the Gulf oil spill. Alaska is about 21 years after the Exxon Valdez with some hindsight, and we're going to be talking about Alaskans who've been down in the Gulf to help out, and we're also talking about the human impact of these kinds of disasters. They're not necessarily new disasters, but we seem to be having more of them, and they have a different impact on people. So we're going to be talking about the human impact of man-made disasters. I've got two guests today. One is Ed Thompson. He's here in the studio with me. Hi, Ed. He's the director for the Crisis Management Unit at BP Exploration Alaska, and he just landed back in Alaska at 3 o'clock this morning, I think. So he's going to give us a bit of an update on what is going on in the Gulf in terms of BP's participation. We hope to have Dr. Steve Pacu on. He's a sociologist who studies the sort of social impact of man-made disasters like the Gulf oil spill or the Exxon Valdez. Our number for you to call in and talk today is 550-8433 in Anchorage. Around the state, it's 1-888-353-5752. And we can also take your email at hometownalaska@kska.org. And before we jump in, I want to remind you that this program is going to air again tonight. So if you miss it or you can't listen to it all, you can listen tonight at 10 o'clock. But you can't call in tonight. This is your only opportunity, and the number in Anchorage is 550-8433. So I also have one other announcement to let you know about. There's going to be an opportunity for a listening session related to the National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon Oil Spill and Offshore Drilling Commission here in Alaska. Chancellor Fran Ulmer's been appointed to that commission. She's going to have a listening session in Anchorage on Wednesday, July 7th, over at the University of Alaska Student Union. And it's from 5 to 7 in the evening. It's open to the public. It's not a Q&A with the chancellor. She hasn't served on this commission yet, she says, but she's really interested in Alaskans and what advice they might have for Gulf residents related to oil spills and preventing them and sort of surviving them. So that's Wednesday, July 7th from 5 to 7 p.m. on the UAA campus in the Student Union. So just want folks to know about that. So, Ed, we're going to turn to you. This is Ed Thompson. He's with BP Exploration Alaska. He is the director for the Crisis Management Unit, which sounds like a pretty heavy title, and in this day and age, pretty serious responsibilities. You've just been down in the Gulf for a month, so let's talk a little bit about what BP Alaska has been doing for the large organization down in the Gulf.
Well, BP Alaska has about 30 people down there helping out the Gulf of Mexico business unit with the response.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a lot of equipment, Alaskan equipment, boom, fire boom, skimmers, things of that nature that have been sent down there.
I read one story that talked about all our dispersants went quickly down to the Gulf. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, all of it.
Yeah. Which this was in a newspaper article, and whoever was talking said, you know, it doesn't work up in our cold waters anyway. I don't know if that's true. But anyway, it's down in the Gulf now.
It would work up here in the cold waters, and it worked just fine down there.
It's been controversial, the dispersants have been, right?
Dispersants have always been controversial, that's right. Mm-hmm. It goes back to 1968 in the Torrey Canyon off of England, when what they used for the spill there were solvents like toluene, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a fellow from the EPA named Ken Biglane who wrote the first national contingency plan for the United States. And he saw that and wrote into the national contingency plan a strong bias towards mechanical containment recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, since then, the science behind dispersants has progressed a great deal.
So let me say, mechanical containment means booms.
Uh-huh.
Okay,
that's right.
So we're just talking physically.
Yeah, sorry
corralling
about the
it up. Yeah.
Terms of art and all that.
But then the dispersants is a different idea. It's I mean, the toxicity is what seems to get people going.
Yeah.
A lot.
As it is right now, the dispersants are no more toxic than the oil you spray them in. But what it does is it breaks the oil up into tiny droplets, and it takes the whole weathering process and dissolution process that would naturally occur over weeks and months, makes it happen in hours and minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And so there certainly, most certainly, is a spike in toxicity because of that rapid weathering that occurs in the water column. Really, it's a trade-off system. And what you're trading off is a short-term, like in the matter of hours, toxicity in the water column for a longer-term impact to the shoreline. So what you're trying to do with dispersants is minimize the impact on the shoreline.
Right. But are you changing the impact on sea life?
The kind of sea life that gets impacted and is copepods and plankton, things of that nature. You have to be very careful where you apply dispersants, because you would never apply them over a nesting area or a place where fish, have their eggs and breed and things like that. You just have to be very careful where you apply it.
But, you know, it's the big wild ocean out there, and even though you plan for it to go in a certain area, you don't always have control over everything.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about what your job is, because you told me you're what, deputy?
Deputy Incident Commander at the Mobile Incident Command Post.
Okay. And what's your day like?
My day? Actually, I'm one of the Deputy Incident Commanders. We have Deputy Incident Commanders that focus on state relationships. We have Deputy Incident Commanders that focus on projects. I'm the Deputy Incident Commander that focuses on keeping the team running. So I'm the second to the Incident Commander, so I stand in for him at the meetings, and I stand in for him for setting objectives, things of that nature.
So when you say keeping the team running, tell me physically, what does that mean? Does that mean that there might be some boats going out and you're actually coordinating and orchestrating that, or is it higher level than that, where you're sort of passing the orders down?
Sure. Let's talk about the scale of the operation. There's probably 1,000 people in the command post in Mobile, Alabama. And there's well over.
That's just one command post.
That's just one of the three that are engaged with this response. And there's well over 10,000 people in the field. In fact, it's closer to 20.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do at the command post in Mobile is we set the objectives, we establish the organizational approach and construct, and we set we have a 24-hour planning cycle, if you will. So every 24 hours, we review the plan for the next 24 hours and communicate that down to the field so they know what to do.
Uh-huh. I see. So basically, keeping the ball rolling, keeping your eye forward, sort of planning it. I'd like to go to the phones, because we've already got a caller with a question about responsibilities. Tom, you're on Hometown Alaska.
Yes. Good afternoon. Hi, Ed. This is Tom. Given the fact that the Gulf oil spill showed the gross overestimation of response capability, is BP now willing to reassess its methodology for estimating the recovery capacity of its skimming systems, potentially using the new ASTM F1780-97 standard for assessing skimming system effectiveness, and upgrading the Alaska spill response plans, which were clearly borrowed from in the Gulf plan, which was grossly unsuccessful?
Well, Tom, is this Tom Lockish?
Yes, it is, Ed.
Okay. I thought I recognized that voice. Tom has been engaged with litigation against the Prince William Sound Sea Plans now since, 1975, Tom? Or 1995?
95, right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Tom, you know, I don't know about the premise of your questions, but I think it'd be safe to say that you learn from every response. And we most certainly are learning things that work and don't work on this response that are going to inform how response is done in the Gulf of Mexico. And quite frankly, we'll bring them back up, some of that stuff back up to Alaska, and take a look at that too. So there's some new techniques, new equipment that are being looked at down there. I think we've actually come up a notch or two on how we do vessels of opportunity and utilizing the fishing fleets in support of a spill response. Back to the theme of this show, I think the Vessel of Opportunity program, among others, is one of the ways we engage people in helping to solve their own problems. And that's a real good thing that we started it here in Alaska. We exported it down to the Gulf of Mexico as an idea. And I think it's gone to really the next level down there. We're going to take some of those learnings back.
Could you describe it? I have a sense of what it is, but why don't you just describe the Vessels of Opportunity?
Sure. Yeah, my first rotation through Mobile was to start up the Vessel of Opportunity program in the Mobile AOR, which is by the way, the states of Mississippi, Alabama, and the Panhandle of Florida. So that's the area of responsibility for Mobile. And what we did was went to the communities, sat down and said, here's how we'd like to use you to support us in cleaning up the oil spill. And the kinds of things we have the local fishermen and the local charter boat captains and even some recreational boats, the kinds of things they do down there are helping to deploy oil containment boom to protect sensitive areas, to maintain that boom. We have almost 1.5 million feet of boom. In miles, that's a big number. It's like, I think it's 1,000 miles or something. We have 1.5 million feet of oil containment boom deployed, so that has to be tended constantly, has to be replaced, has to be fixed. They're helping us with that. And as they're going through training programs to learn how to operate skimmers, to learn how to do oil recovery on the water, and as they finish those training programs, they get assigned to task forces that go out and help collect the oil that comes through the nearshore area.
Tom, did that answer your question?
Well, no. It really gets down to the methodology that they use in assessing their recovery rates. The way the government does it now is that they only require them to consider essentially one parameter, the size of the pump on the skimmer. And that leaves out all of the other factors, such as how thinly the oil spill spreads. So if you don't plan for weather and the spreading of the spill, you essentially will always get the same result, and there will never be any incentive beyond, you know, putting a big pump on the skimmers like they did with the Graham wrecks. They just found the biggest pump that they could and put it on this cobbled together skimmer that was never tested. And they met the regulatory standard, the federal regulatory standard. I'm contesting whether they met the state regulatory standard, which requires them to also consider how much a boom is needed to concentrate the oil to get it to the skimmer, and whether they are appropriately accounting for the reduction in removal rates caused by adverse weather and environmental conditions. And what is really needed here is a total reworking of the criteria used to evaluate skimming system effectiveness, because we will always fall far short. A study done by the Prince William Sound RCAC says that the current systems employed in Prince William Sound could be as much as a factor of 20 short of meeting the regulatory standard. And unless we adopt a new system of evaluating skimming system effectiveness, we will always get oil spreading out of control and devastating our shorelines. And I'd like to know if BP is going to commit to a more scientific method of evaluating their skimming system effectiveness.
Okay, Ed. There's the question.
Sure. You got to understand, Tom's been engaged in litigation against the plan holders in Alaska since 95. And because of that, and we have ongoing litigation with Tom right now.
Right. Well, we could.
But I'd be happy to try to answer your question, Tom.
If you agree to reassess it, we don't need to litigate it, Ed. We can sit down together and find solutions that are in Alaskans' best interest. I'm only litigating it because you refuse to do the right thing that has proven to be catastrophic.
Okay, Tom, thank you. I think you made your point. And one of the things we're trying to cover in this program is to really talk about the human impact and, you know, some of it emerges way over time. You're sort of right at the cusp of some environmental and scientific and judgment calls there. So I think the larger issue I see here is really sort of trust. You know, can we trust? And I'd like to take the question there, because that's sort of the human element. We all want to turn on our car. We all want to turn up the heat. We all want to do these things and use this resource. And we have entrusted the people to go get it. And actually, we hope that they're going to do it right. And there's an issue of trust there. So, you know, that's what I'm trying to get at. I don't know that Ed can actually... he's going to jump in. Okay.
I'll give it a try. I'm afraid the human impact of my answer may be to put the audience to sleep, but here we go.
We don't want to do that.
We don't want to do that. No,
we don't want to do that.
Yeah, so let's try to keep it a little bit upbeat.
Okay, let's.
Well, first off, we assert that our plans meet all the regulatory requirements. They've been approved by the state. They've been approved by the federal government. You know, we've been there. Tom doesn't agree, so he litigates. Okay, so there's that point. But you know, I think there is something to talk about in terms of what is the state of the art in terms of oil spill cleanup and the difficulty of that goes out there. The work that goes on offshore in the Gulf of Mexico, you know, as we speak, is certainly hampered by wind and weather and waves and the tropical storm now or hurricane.
Alex. Mm-hmm.
That's down in the southwest part of the Gulf. And there are limitations. Remember when I talked about Ken Biglain really focusing the National Contingency Plan on mechanical containment and recovery?
Right.
Honestly, and you know, I've been doing oil spill response since 1975, as we talked about before the show. It's difficult to do mechanical containment and recovery and get success rates that in the real world with all the factors that are involved in the bad weather and things of that nature. That are much better than 20% effectiveness in terms of if you spill it, you know your ability to contain and recover it on the water is
about 20%
on a good day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's more than the things that Tom's talking about. There's just the National Contingency Plan focuses you on a very difficult method to clean it up. I think most agencies that respond now. The Coast Guard being one, EPA being another, and the state, as well as the industry that I represent today, believe that there are other tools in the toolbox. There's the use of dispersants, and there's also in-situ burning, where you collect it in a pool and burn it. Those are more tools that can be used. The whole focus in life is to minimize the impact of the oil on the people, the environment, in the way of life, you know, for the fishes, the animals, and the people.
Right, right.
And so, that's really what we're all about. And to do that, you got to use all the tools that are there.
Yeah. Well, to get to this question of trust, it seems to me that BP has, they're out there, they're doing a lot, they're sort of cutting edge. But there's some recent history that would suggest we've had a number of accidents. Mm-hmm. We had one in Alaska in 2006. It was a spill for which BP paid for, and you know, basically was told you didn't monitor the corrosion as carefully as you should have. So you're gonna pay a price for that. I'm still trying to get at this question of trust because I hope we're going to hear from Dr. Steve Bakou, who's really focused a lot on this. Just in the last weekend, I read two stories about Alaskans offering advice mm-hmm. to folks in the Gulf. And I wonder if you're experiencing this when you go down there at all. But a fisherman in Cordova said, you know, you just can't trust anything an oil company tells you. And they were pretty universal about that. It wasn't just BP. It was, so what's it like to kind of fight this battle with people maybe suspecting that you did cut corners or even being able to point to your recent record and see things that didn't quite seem up to snuff? I mean, regardless of what you might have tried to do internally, something bad happened. Now people think you're the bad guy. So, I mean, you know, and you're right in the middle of trying to clean up this spill and do it the best you can. So how do you cope with the fact that people don't trust very much right now? Or do you find that to be true?
Well, dealing, you know, the people in the Gulf Coast that I have dealt with, and I've stood in unair-conditioned rooms with 700 Biola battery fishermen and had to walk up and said, "Hi, I'm Ed Thompson. I'm from BP." And I never once felt animosity. I only felt interest, concern. People ask questions, hard questions. Some people were upset, you know, over the issue. But to a person, uh, I I've been amazed. In fact, when I started out the Vessel of Opportunity program, our first foray out into talking to people was just that. It was in Bayou La Batre, and it was, 700 fishermen in an unair-conditioned area. Well, politics being what it was, some politicians came in and just kind of usurped the entire meeting, and we weren't very successful at recruiting fishermen that day. So the next day, we went to a local church and tried to set up a meeting, and we thought we'd have like 40 fishermen, and 600 showed up. And we jam-packed into this little auditorium. And to a person, they came to us and said, "We are very sorry about yesterday. You were treated rudely and unfairly, and we're not raised that way. Mm-hmm. And yes, we want to get engaged. We want to be involved. We want to do this." And so, I can't, as a BP employee, I feel the crushing disappointment of this thing. I think all of us do. But the only thing we can do is work to make it better. And what I've found is on the impacted people have the same opinion, is they're upset. I'm upset because this happened and it happened with my company. They're upset because it happened in their backyard to them.
Mm-hmm.
But the common ground, I think, where you build the trust is in working together to solve the problem. And that to me is fertile ground for all of us. If we can focus on the problem and work it. And I have to tell you, going around our area, our AOR in Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida, once you cut through the rhetoric and you cut through the people who have a particular position to take for whatever economic or political reason they have to take a position in public, when you cut down to the people that are actually with you working, it's a tremendous relationship. And we learn to trust each other because we take care of each other.
Well, that's really different from what you would, at least what I have read recently about the way, say, communities feel in Cordova, for example. I mean, one of the issues that Dr. Pacu has brought up is there's a struggle in a community that's been impacted by an oil spill when your fishing vessels of opportunity, opportunity comes up, and people feel like they shouldn't work for what they see as the perceived enemy.
Sure.
But then some do, and I think there was a term coined up in Alaska, spillionaires, for fishermen who went to work for the Exxon to sort of help clean up.
That term made it down to the Gulf, by the way.
Is it already in the Gulf? Spillionaires?
Yeah. What we're trying to do, by the way, on that is we're rotating people through the Vessel of Opportunity program to ensure that we don't have a small segment of the population
being made
rich, if you will, and the rest are in trouble. So we're cycling people through the program so everyone has a chance.
It seems like that's one of the things we learned from Exxon. It's just the effects are longer term. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we've learned about man-made disasters is that we can all come together when there's a terrible earthquake, or we can all come together when there's a tsunami. We all feel we're in this together. And somehow we seem to lose that we're all in this together feeling if there is an entity that is somehow held responsible or isn't accepting responsibility for. And so that's sort of, but I think it's a simplistic view of the situation, since I really would say we are all in this together. We're all, the demand for the fuel, the demand is there. There's issues around, say, BP's profit margins that people would like to get upset about. But something that's different in the Gulf is the escrow fund that was set up by BP at President Obama's behest. But an attempt, again, to not maybe have some of those claim issues that we had in Alaska, being sort of sorted out by an oil company. Now there's going to be an independent party sorting out some of these claims. And that seems like something that's different and maybe something we learned from what we experienced up in Alaska.
I think having an independent claim adjuster, if you want of a better word, I think will work for the benefit of all and help us all. But I guess my point is that I understand the sense of outrage. And I think a lot of BP employees feel, disappointed and sad that this occurred. And to a person within the company, there's 100,000 BP employees, and I think around the world, we're all disappointed and sad that this occurred. It's like if you were driving your car and you had a terrible accident that resulted in terrible things occurring, you would feel awful, but you would do your very best to make it better. And I think that's where we are. I guess the attitude that we have within BP is to roll our sleeves up and this isn't good. It's not good to be BP at this point in time,
mm-hmm.
but we're going to go ahead and we're going to do the very best we can to fix it. And what I've found is that when you work side by side with somebody, even if they are the victim of the accident that you had, you work side by side with them, there's tremendous trust, even camaraderie that occurs.
And, it sounds like it's the kind of one-on-one relationship that you, Ed Thompson, are able to,
yeah.
you know, develop by looking somebody right in the eye and being down there with them. But you might not be there you're going to be there for a while, but then you're eventually going to go on with your life. And a lot of the research that Dr. Pacu has looked at
mm-hmm.
is 10 years out
right.
or even 20 years out. You could have a positive impact because people could feel like, I work next to Ed Thompson and I know that he did the best he could. But the fact is, they do say once the oil is out, you know, you've got a different problem, you know.
Yeah.
And people would wish that we didn't get the oil out in the first place. So so I don't know.
We are all in this together.
Yeah.
We really are.
Yeah.
The energy system in the United States is something we are all invested in. And you trust us to do it right. We made a mistake, and we're going to make it better.
I've got an email question that came in. It's a good one. It's coming from the Prince William Sound Regional Citizen Advisory Council folks, who you probably
I know
aware
most
of them. And they have a question that they would. We were talking about the incident action plans, and you know that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically when I was getting ready for this program, I heard that BP does a really good job up in Alaska. They've got these, but that isn't what's happening down in the Gulf. So this question says, where can we find the incident action plans as they are not available on the Deepwater Horizon BP site? So do you know?
I believe the incident action plans are available on a website. Do you know who from the RCAC that came from?
Linda Swiss sent us the note.
Okay, I know Linda. So if you could just let Linda know, I'll go ahead and find the website address that where she can dig into that. And there's no secrets on the incident action plan.
Right.
There's at least two, if not three, but there's an incident action plan put together for HOMA Incident Command Post, which covers the Louisiana and the Mississippi Delta area. And then there's an incident action plan put together for the Mobile Incident Command Post that covers Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida.
But you haven't actually looked at it yourself on the BP site.
No, I read the incident action plan every day I'm there in print.
In print, okay.
So,
all right.
Yeah, I don't need to go to the site to get it.
Right. I guess I just trying to figure out other ways of tackling this issue of the human dimension and the human impact.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you know you won't be around for very long, and people's lives, they're sort of, that's what a lot of this difficulty is, when people can't, when there's no accountability, or they feel there's not an accountability, and then maybe some people go to work for an oil company in the cleanup. And that there's sort of fissures in the community that start to develop. And I don't know whether BP attempts to do anything related to these kinds of social issues at all. You're so busy mopping up oil at this point or figuring out what dispersants to put down. But
uh-huh.
The truth is, does BP think about this human impact and the longer term issue?
Yeah, we do. And we're people. We're part of the communities we live in and operate in and all that. One of the things that happened after the Exxon Valdez, we've often said in the office that the Alaskan community, the Alaskan population, is some of the most knowledgeable consumers of oil spill information on the planet. They are engaged, know it, understand it, are challenging when they need to be, are partners when they can be. And honestly, I think a development of some of that culture elsewhere would be good. I think all of us, it's part of that ownership in the energy system of the United States that you and I talked about before the show and alluded to a little bit here during the show. And that, you know, you're part of a broad and complex world, and You need to know these things. You need to be engaged in these things.
That's a long-term picture, and it's the long-term reality. And then you have an acute crisis, and then it all goes to heck in a handbasket. We'll be back in the second half of the show, but I'm here with Ed Thompson, who's a crisis management director of BP Alaska. He's been deployed to the Gulf for the last 30 days. He flew in today at 3:00 in the morning. He's doing some more scheduling up here and then going back down to the Gulf. We'll hear from Dr. Steve Pacu in the second half of our show, we hope. And this is Kathleen McCoy, and I'm on Hometown Alaska.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the show repeats tonight at 10. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking phone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, you can also find a copy of today's Hometown Alaska online at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Hi, this is Kathleen McCoy, and we're on Hometown Alaska. Our topic today is lessons from Exxon Valdez being shared with the Gulf oil spill communities. I'm on with Ed Thompson, who's a crisis management director for Alaska BP, and he's been deployed to the Gulf and just flew in this morning. Ed's been talking to us about it's called Vessels of Opportunity program that was initiated up in Alaska and used again down in the Gulf. I'd like to invite our callers to call in with questions for Ed. The local number is 550-8433, or if you're outside of Anchorage, you can call 1-888-353-5752 or send an email to hometownalaska@kska.org. I also want to remind our listeners that there is going to be an opportunity for a listening session related to the National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon Oil Spill and Offshore Drilling. That is a mouthful. From Alaska, Chancellor Fran Ulmer's been invited to be a part of that commission, which is going to investigate the causes of the explosion and maybe recommend some changes to prevent future disasters. So she's going to hold a listening session at the University of Alaska in the Student Union from 5 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, July 7th. So that's open to the public, and anyone is invited to sort of, you know, go in and offer advice from the Alaska perspective on what might we share with the Gulf residents on surviving a spill like we had here in 1989 and they are experiencing now on the Gulf Coast. So I'm going to turn to the phones. Bob, you're on Hometown Alaska.
Good afternoon. Ed, it's good to have you on. You sound like a reasonable person. Frankly, that's a bit of a surprise. But
well, how do you take that, Ed? Go ahead, Bob.
Let me just launch in, if I might. I don't expect you to admit negligence. You did admit a mistake. In my view, as a shareholder, actually, I think BP unfortunately cut corners and put profit ahead of the interest of the public with respect to oil exploration in deep waters. But I understand that you might not be able to comment on negligence, but if you can just assume negligence for discussion purposes and strictly that, my question is, why should people feel good about BP's role in overseeing the cleanup? I realize there's federal oversight of that. But why should we feel good about BP doing the cleanup, given the assumed negligence on your part in causing the spill in the first place?
Well, it ties two thoughts together. It's hard for me to react to that. To tie together, the you know what happened to lead to the spill itself. With our response, you know, I guess in my mind's eye, I see, you know, first off, there's a strong commitment to respond to this in the very best manner we can. I've been all over the United States cleaning up oil spills in my first career as a Coast Guard officer, and I've also attended a number of drills and exercises with BP folks around the lower 48, as well as running BP system here in Alaska. And I can tell you, here in Alaska, for example, we have well over, 1,000 people dedicated to our response system here in Alaska. We run a fully certified fire department here in Alaska. We have fully certified ambulance departments. We run a city up on the North Slope, and we drill. We are committed. This is what we do, and that culture permeates through BP. We understand our need to belly up to the bar in bad times and do the very best we can to do it. I think the proof is in the pudding. I think there was a lot of voices that were calling for a government takeover of the response. And honestly, I was a federal on-scene coordinator in my previous life, and you spend your day asking the question, can I do this better? And if you can do it better, you take two steps. The first step is you go to the responsible party and you say, do it better. And if they up their game, you continue on. If they don't, you take it over. And I can tell you that question is being asked in a lot of quadrants. Can I do better? And no one has been able to really outstrip the level of resources, the commitment, the coordination and effort that's gone into this. It's unmatched and it's unparalleled in history. This is a far larger response than the Exxon Valdez. We have put a larger footprint on a larger piece of geography with more people trained and coordinated, with more agency oversight involved. And the unified command in Mobile alone is 7 agencies.
Let me jump in here, Joe.
So they're there. I mean, nobody can do it better.
Well, what I wanted to jump in here, Bob, and say is that the lack of trust really goes beyond companies and sometimes even to government agencies, as we've had news stories that have shown there's too close of a relationship. You know, government agents that were supposed to get permits, you know, signed, sealed, and delivered, maybe overlooked them. So I'm just wondering whether the Exxon Valdez emphasis, the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, gave us the Prince William Sound Regional Citizen Advisory Council, and that introduced this notion of not only government looking and industry trying to do its best, but also citizen oversight. And I just almost feel like we need a lot of eyes on it. And I wonder if, you know, Bob, that makes a difference to you that we've got a citizen oversight group here that seems to be working pretty closely with the industry, changing expectations and changing performance.
It does help. It's very important, and I think a similar body for the TAPS, Alaska, would be a very good idea. But if I can go back to Ed's original analogy, if one was involved in a serious accident, you'd feel really bad and want to do everything you could for the victims. But if one was drunk when the accident happened, then you might not look to them to be the first responder to the victims. And that's kind of the dilemma that BP's conduct prior to the spill itself creates for me. And I'll kind of leave it at that and won't belabor it. But I'd invite comment.
Thanks, Bob.
Okay.
Comment, Ed?
I understand. The disappointment and anger, and it's noted. We feel it as BP employees. We feel it and understand it. That's all I can tell you. And our commitment is to do the very best we can to move forward.
Just want to throw the phone number out there one more time. It's 550-8433 in Anchorage. And statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752. And we also welcome your emails at hometownalaska@kska.org. I'm going to go to the phones again. And Martha, you're on Hometown Alaska.
Thank you. And thank you to the gentleman from BP for appearing on the radio show. And I'll call you Ed, like the last caller who was one of your shareholders. And my name is Martha. And I really take issue with some of the comments you've been making. And I'll have to say that the one you made a couple of times that I've heard, which is that you'll make things better, really does not sit well with me. And I will put out another thought for people, especially those of you who are in the oil industry business, and for people in, even as far as Washington, especially people representing Alaskans in Washington. And when we're talking about what happened, it wasn't an accident. It was something preventable. And when you talk about making things better, when you talk about recovery of only up to 20% in the best of circumstances, really, when people are looking to be made whole again, or for their land to be made whole again, or for their water to be made whole again. And so for the President of the United States and for you as a representative of BP to, in a way, spout platitudes, there are Alaskans who are still suffering the effects of the Exxon Valdez, and there are people and you mentioned the proof is in the pudding. In the case of BP, over two decades later, the proof is not in the pudding. The proof is in the Gulf. And when you look at terminology, I would hope that people in the business would talk about deep water drilling, and then try to say that shallow water drilling off the coast of Alaska should be made the exception, because there is talk of what would happen in the Arctic waters if the worst were to happen. And those those concerns have been largely ignored. And when you look at what has happened with the Minerals Management Service and the charges made against them within their own overseers, the federal government, then you wonder about the whole process here in Alaska as far as approving a shell to drill offshore. So terminology, to me, it's not about deep water versus shallow water. The proper terminology is frontier drilling, and you're not prepared. So if you're not, and you cut corners, and you save dollars, and now look at your reputation, look at how you've been hit on the bottom line, listen to the last person who is one of your own shareholders, talk about negligence. So these are criminal terms people are talking about, and there are people who are going to say you committed crimes. So as far as talking about the Arctic and what's happening here in Alaska, as someone who lives in Anchorage but who traces my ancestry in part back to the Arctic, I will have to say that shallow water, deep water, it's frontier drilling, and you don't appear to be knowing what you're doing, you do know what you're doing, and you appear to not have cared. So that's my comment. My comments.
Thanks, Martha.
Thank you. Thank you for being on the air.
Well, as you can see, people are upset, right?
Absolutely.
And you're not surprised. You know, part of that is maybe the history of promising to make things whole again. And I think this was Exxon Valdez that promised, we will make you whole again. Maybe it's not possible to put the genie back in the bottle, you know? I mean, what do you think about that, Ed?
Well, I think the analog of the genie out of the bottle is a good one. And you can't take away all impacts. You can only minimize them and then do the best you can to heal and help the healing process. That's really the key thing. And we have to figure that out. Right now we are in the middle of trying to mitigate the impacts with the response. We're in the middle of that.
In the acute stages. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But there's a chronic problem here, really.
And long term, we have to find a way to accelerate or support the healing process, because healing comes from within, and we need to support that. We need to help that. I understand that, and part of that is first and foremost doing the response correctly and building the partnerships, allowing people to put hands on the problem solving, I think, mm-hmm. is an important thing. Mm-hmm. It is for me anyway. If I was forced to stand on the sidelines and watch someone else fix something, that's much less satisfying than being able to go in and put my hands on the problem itself and do the best I could to help solve it. So
you're
we're trying to do that.
About that. You're convincing about that, and I hear you, but I would say I think Martha makes a good point when you look back at the record and you see on the record that corners were cut, that, you know, up here in Alaska in 2006, we had 200,000, you know, leak out, you know, those things, or even the loss of lives on the deep water horizon is kind of a scary thing, you know. So, it's hard to come out of the hole you're in. It's almost like we were driving fast and then we ran a light and hit something. And so, you know, of course we're driving fast because we want all this stuff. I mean, it's not just that you're having difficulty selling your product. You're not having difficulty selling your product. So, but I want to go to the phones again. We've got another caller. Roy, you're on Hometown Alaska.
Hi, Ed. This is Roy from RCAC.
Hey, Roy. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Hey, I wanted to get back to the IEP issue just a little bit. We've tried multiple sources to try to get access to the IEPs to be able to follow the response. I think there's a lot of lessons learned and stuff that would come out of those. And we use them up here in Alaska, as you know, that, you know, we can get on the ADC website whenever there's a spill response and see those. And we hadn't been able to find them. We've looked on the, since you mentioned that earlier, we looked on the BP website and still couldn't find them. And from some of the people that we've heard from down there, they're being restricted. But if that's not the case, we'd love to be able to see them just so we can follow the response.
I'll look into it and get back to you, Roy.
You know, okay,
Roy, you were down there in the early days.
Down in Louisiana?
Yeah.
Actually, Joe Banta went down for our organization, and I haven't been down there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know, I just wanted to tell our listeners that we have put a couple of things on our website, kska.org, that they might find useful. One of them is the BP Horizon, Deepwater Horizon response site, but we also have NOAA's response site. We also have the Prince William Sound Regional Citizen Advisory Council's website, which has produced another separate website of information that agency thinks would be useful to Gulf reporters, Gulf workers. Those are all on kska.org, and so I really would encourage people to not miss the opportunity. And in fact, the very website Roy's talking about is listed, so people can maybe, you know, the crowdsourcing opportunity here is for people to go on that website and see if they can find it. If the RCAC can't find it, it's a little bit disturbing. So I don't know. I know that Dr. Pacu, in his work, has talked about the importance of information coming out so people feel that there's a lot of transparency. And so that's a value that I think we're talking about right here.
I'll look into that.
Right.
Thank you, Roy. That I think we can fix pretty quick.
Thank you, Roy. Anything else?
That was my primary concern.
Well,
actually, Ed, one more thing I'd ask is if you could give us any insight on the capping progress.
That's a good opportunity since you just got back in.
Well, we hear the report from we hear the report from the Houston Incident Management Team twice a day on the capping process, and the relief well is very close. And I think this is all in the public domain. The relief well is very close to the well bore, and has a number of hundreds of feet left to go down to get to the bottom. And the goal is to get to the bottom of the stricken well, and so that they can pump from that and get the highest column of kill weight fluid they can.
Yeah, I read that story. I just wanted to tell our listeners, when we get the link from Ed Thompson, who is a crisis manager from BP, we will post it on kska.org. This is related to Roy's question about where are the incident reports on Deepwater Horizon BP's incident site. So we will put that on kska.org. So folks who've called, we've had a number of callers who wanted to find out where is that. We'll post it on kska.org.
Sure.
And I want to turn to the phones again. We've got a caller from Eagle River. You're on Hometown Alaska. Hi, Kenneth.
Oh, hi. I'd just like to make a couple of comments regarding the difference between the Exxon Valdez spill and what BP's response has been. I boated in Prince William Sound for 11 years prior to the spill, and then worked throughout that summer on skiffs cleaning up oil. And I've got to credit BP for a lot of the public relations differences between what they're doing versus how Exxon handled the spill. Number one, if it is true that you are rotating some of the fishing vessels and other vessels that are involved in the spill and contracted out so that they're not the spillionaires, whereas so many others are left holding the catastrophe with nothing in their wallets. And I certainly hope BP is continuing with that. The other aspect of it that I think is real important is it appears that BP is holding themselves responsible for the actual work that's taking place, whereas Exxon seemed to have let the responsibility out to Vico, and as those of us in Alaska know, that didn't work out so well.
So you go ahead, Ken.
The gist of it is it does appear to me right now that BP is handling the job much better than Exxon did.
Well, that's a bit of a thumbs up for you, Ed, in a tough time. Yeah, I mean, I think that is a real tangible thing. We're rotating mm-hmm. people into those opportunities. That's a tangible thing that's different.
Yeah, it is.
But I mean, I've heard criticism of BP's sort of information systems, things like, you know, 5,000 gallons a day, and then that having to be, whether or not that was intentional, it looked like they were readjusting the figures a lot. The controversy over the dispersants. You know, it almost looked like BP was ordered to the White House and told to do the $20 billion escrow. You know, I've heard people say BP watched Exxon and learned how better to handle, you know, the inquiries than, you know, so that also BP learned. Now, that's the harsher view of it, but at least you've got callers that at least don't agree with that. But what else do you think might be... Sure, Kenneth.
I worked on the Corexit crew out in Prince William Sound, the experiment on Smith Island. And I really do wish that something was publicized regarding the results of that. And I know that there's so much difference between the crude in the Gulf and versus the crude from the North Slope. But it was so obvious that the dispersant did a wonderful job of cleaning from the rocks and from dispersing the oil, but it popped up later on down the water table.
That's an interesting point. So, in other words, it does an immediate good mm-hmm. job, but then it doesn't...
It looks good for a while, and then further down, it washes up and just hits another area, albeit with a little bit of a different consistency to it with the North Slope crude. Not quite as waxy, but... got to wonder where the rest of it went, and Prince William Sound in particular is very deep, as we all know.
Have you seen it pop up again later after dispersants have kind of spread it around?
During the cleanup efforts on the experimental use of Corexit.
And I'm just wondering if Ed's seen that in the Gulf.
Well, I was in the command post when they did that test on Smith Island back in 89. Working on the spill, and that was a surface washing agent. It wasn't a dispersant. They had deliberately modified the formulation so that it would wash off the surface but not disperse into the water column. So it was meant to pop back up. In fact, it was actually probably a good thing that it did. But that there's been a lot of talk about. Oil popping back up and all that, and oil's behavior in the environment when it's out in the environment can be quite complex, and it's because the environment itself, the ocean itself, is quite complex, and you have oil at all different stages of weathering. The ultimate fate of weathering is to bring it to a tarball consistency, which is like a little chunk of asphalt, if you will, mm-hmm. And that's what we call neutrally buoyant. So it's based on the currents and what's going on in the winds, it can go under and come back up, and all those things can occur.
And actually, we're learning as we go. Is that safe to say?
Well, you learn a number of things. You know the general fate and effects of oil in the environment, but that every time you take a really close look, I mean, quite frankly, no one's measured the Gulf of Mexico like it's being measured right now. And there are things you learn about how the currents go, both in a, you know, in a map view, but also vertically within the water column itself, how the currents go, that you know, people didn't know about before.
Because we weren't there before. We
weren't looking before.
Yeah, right. Well, I just want to remind our callers, we've been talking this hour about Alaska's experience with Exxon Valdez and how, what lessons we're able to take to the Gulf. We've had a number of Alaskans, both for BP and independent Alaskans, who've gone down to the Gulf and have been working there, trying to share the information that and the lessons from here. We've had Ed Thompson from BP Alaska Exploration. He's the crisis management guy up in Alaska, and he's been deployed for a month, and he's going back, I think, in a week. We weren't able to have Dr. Steve Pacu on, but I do want to let our listeners know that on our website, we do have something that Dr. Pacu worked on after Exxon Valdez oil spill, which was to go into the communities and really do a lot of listening to the impacts, the social impacts, and the community fragmentation that happened when the Exxon Valdez effects started to be felt in Cordova and Homer and in communities that were spilled. There's peer listening. It's like a DVD, but it's split up on the Prince William Sound website. So people can go on that website, go to kskga.org and find the Citizen Advisory website and look at those, because that really addresses some of the issues that are still going on in Alaska today, which is, it's really amazing. And Ed, I just want to thank you. I know that you landed today at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you know, even catching you in the Gulf was really pretty difficult, because I'd often leave messages or your phone was already full. But I think we're not out of the deep water here yet. I even think Alaskans have continuing concerns about what's going to happen in Alaska based on the Gulf. But I want to thank you for your time. And I want to let listeners know that next week on Hometown Alaska, Tika Ballas, we'll be talking about sexual assault and the rising numbers in Alaska. And, you know, I want people to know they can listen to this program again at 10 o'clock tonight. You can't call in with your questions, but you can make comment and, you know, check out those websites that we've got listed on kska.org. And Ed, I want to thank you. Do you have any parting words for us?
Well, thanks for the opportunity, and it was good to hear the concerns and issues on the other side of the line.
You felt a little bit like you're on the hot seat.
A little bit, but, you know, it's understandable.
Yeah. Well, it goes with the territory. Mm-hmm. I guess it goes with the salary. I don't know. That's a tough thing to say, but that's sort of partly, yeah, I don't think we could have nonprofit oil companies, you know, I mean, that model doesn't work. The exploration isn't there. So anyway, thank you to our listeners. Thank you to our callers. We had a great program today. And thank you very much. Hometown Alaska. Bye-bye.
Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated News and Public Media. An archived copy of today's program, additional information, and links to all the websites mentioned on today's show are available online at kska.org. Send us your comments and suggestions of things you'd like to talk about at Hometown Alaska, 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. This is KSKA Anchorage.